Good morning, Community Mennonite. It's so good to be worshiping with you this morning. I was just thinking that it was 3 years ago this month that you sent me off to go to seminary in New York City. And here I am, right back here. When I entered seminary, I didn't expect to have quite the transformative experience that I ended up having. I entered seminary with more than my fair share of questions. For some of those questions, I got answers, but for the most part, I traded them in for bigger and better questions. At seminary, I walked in protests and pride marches. I came to know Jesus more deeply and more intimately through my friendships with people who are not even Christian. I wrote good papers weeks before they were due, but I wrote my best papers the night before they were due. I shared meals with people who live in penthouses and people who live on street corners, and I found God in unexpected places, or perhaps I should say, God found me. And then, this May, I graduated. And not 1 week later, I get this email, and it's from my student loan servicer. And it says, "Dear Scott, congratulations on your graduation, period. We look forward to the successful repayment of your student loans." And then I learned something else. That no matter how deeply spiritual we are, the issue of money and finances always hangs over our heads. I feel like this is the point at the beginning of the sermon where I should make a quick disclaimer that I'm going to be talking about money today. So if you want to make a quick run for the exit, I don't think anybody will judge you. There's a little statistic that we preachers like to use every now and then that says that Jesus talked more about money than he did about love. In fact, Jesus talked more about money than any other topic. And I don't think it's because Jesus was obsessed with money. I think it's because he knew something about us. And this is true of any individual or church or politician or business or nonprofit. What we do with what we have been given says far more about us than the words that come out of our mouth. In today's scripture, Jesus is addressing thousands of people who have gathered simply to hear him talk. All of a sudden, out of the crowd, a man shouts, "Hey, Jesus, tell my brother to divide the family inheritance with me." Those of you who grew up with siblings know exactly how this conversation goes. But Jesus refuses. You see, in first century Palestine, it was the role of rabbis to interpret the Mosaic law and settle disputes between people. But Jesus says, "I'm not that kind of rabbi." And instead of handing out a ruling, he tells a story. There once was a rich man who owned a very large parcel of land. One year, that land yielded an abundant harvest. When he saw all of the crops that were being brought in from the field, he realized that he had more food than even his capacity to store it. So that day he resolved to tear down his barns and in their place build even bigger ones so that he could live the rest of his life in luxury. But on the very night that he had finished building his newer, larger barns, he died, unable to enjoy the very abundance that his land had produced. Now you can imagine the confusion of those thousands of people as they heard this story. Jesus told a lot of parables, but he rarely explained them. And most of the time, there are multiple ways of interpreting the same story. Is Jesus telling the first guy not to worry about the inheritance? Or is he warning the brother, who's presumably also there, against the greed of holding on to all of the family's wealth? Or was Jesus saying something different to both of them and to us today? Meanwhile, in Colossians, Paul tells a community of Jesus followers that since they are a new creation, they should set their minds on things above and not things on earth. Put to death all of the earthly things within you so that you can be more like Christ in heaven. It's no wonder, then, that so many Christians throughout history have interpreted these two scriptures to mean that we should only concern ourselves with spiritual things, that topics like money and politics have no place in the church. But the problem is, this is an interpretation that is only available to the wealthiest individuals. If you don't know where your next meal is coming from, you have no choice but to think about worldly things. If you don't know where you're going to sleep tonight, you can't help but count your earthly possessions. You can be like me and retreat into seminary for 3 years and study the scriptures and point your mind toward God, but at the very end, the student loan bill is coming. There's no such thing as a non-political gospel. In fact, if you look throughout history, you'll find that the Christians who most believed in a non-political gospel are the ones who have the greatest material interest in making sure the status quo doesn't change. But if we take a closer look at what Paul is saying, when he tells us to set our minds on Jesus, it will change the way we relate to others. It will have a material consequence for our lives. In fact, I would argue that the only way to see Jesus is not by turning our minds toward heaven, but by turning to our neighbors and finding the living Christ in them. And if your neighbor is suffering, that means Jesus is suffering too. Paul tells us powerfully that through our renewal in Jesus Christ, there is no longer Greek and Jew, circumcised and uncircumcised, barbarian, Scythian, slave and free, but Christ is all and in all. This does not mean that our identities are wiped away and our differences are erased, but it does mean that we must change the way we relate to one another in the midst of differences. Paul is not saying that it does not matter whether you are an enslaved person or an enslaver. Paul is saying that in the new creation, enslaved people are freed from being enslaved, and enslavers are freed from being enslavers. So when we return to Jesus' parable, we can see that this rich man did not really die on the night before he retired. No, the day that he truly died was when he found he had an overabundant harvest, and instead of saying, "This is good news for us," he said, "This is good news for me." Instead of building a bigger table, he built a larger barn. And sure, his lungs may have continued to draw breath, and his heart may have continued to beat, but what kind of life is that really? One where you're so disconnected from the humanity of your neighbors that you can only think of yourself. And that's not a real life. The truth is, even though the rich man had an abundance of crops and an abundance of land and an abundance of money, he was trapped in a mindset of scarcity. He didn't know how to live abundantly. If you view the world through the lens of scarcity, you will always be dissatisfied. Every dollar your neighbor has is a dollar that you don't have. You may be a billionaire, but if you live with a scarcity mindset, you will always feel like you don't have enough money. This is what Paul meant when he said in today's scripture that greed is really just another form of idolatry. But if you live abundantly, you may very well be poor, But you will also know that life consists in so much more than how much money you have. I have a very close mentor in New York City who told me one time, some weeks I choose not to tithe because I feel like I can't afford to. When that happens, I spend the rest of my week feeling like I'm struggling to get by. But when I do tithe, even in those weeks where I don't feel like I can afford it, I spend the rest of the week feeling like I have enough. Now, this isn't a prosperity gospel. What changes in these two scenarios is not how much money he has, but what changes is his mindset about his money. And that's what it means to live abundantly. I want to tell you a story that I heard in the news 2 weeks ago. On the morning of July 22nd, a resident of Nashville, Tennessee, and his 12-year-old son walked out of their house and climbed inside the family van, which was parked in the driveway. All of a sudden, they were swarmed by immigration and customs enforcement officers who had been watching their house for days, waiting for the right moment to strike. Now, this father had lived in Nashville for 14 years. But hatred and xenophobia are on the rise in this country, the likes of which harkens back to the rise of fascism in Nazi Germany, and which yesterday prompted multiple terror attacks. As a result, the Nashville family and thousands of others live with targets on their back. Fortunately, this man thought very quickly and he locked the car doors before the ICE officers could force them open. The officers harassed the father and the son, and they used illegal tactics to try to drive them out of the van. But that's when their neighbors began to peek out their windows to see what all the commotion was about. When they saw that this family was in danger, the whole community sprang into action. As word spread, more and more people came and surrounded the van. They linked arms and they formed a human chain, protecting the family from the ICE officers. Meanwhile, some other people left, and they brought food and wet rags so that the father and son could stay cool in the car. And some people ran to the gas station, and they brought back tanks of gas, and they filled up the car so that it could stay running in the driveway. After a four-hour-long standoff, the ICE officers gave up and left. All of the neighbors cheered. Here's the thing. Nashville, like many cities, has wages that are stagnating and costs of living that are increasing. Maybe some of those neighbors missed work that day and they didn't get paid. Maybe some risked arrest, knowing that they wouldn't be able to afford bail. Maybe some ran and got food for this family, even though they struggled to put food on their own table. For every single person who committed to protecting this family, there were a million good reasons not to, and one very big reason to do so. Because they're human beings. And the fabric of our lives are woven into community such that what hurts you also hurts me. And what is good for you is good for me. I want to read you a direct quote from Felicia Day Young, who is one of the neighbors who stepped up that day. This is what she told the local news channel. It's going to happen again. They're going to come back, and we're going to come back too. And we're going to be even stronger, and we're going to learn how to protect one another. We're going to be there for them and let them know that we are a community, that we are going to stick together. That's what we're supposed to do. I don't care where you come from, we're supposed to stick together. God made all of us. It could be me, it could be my family, it could be anybody, it could be your neighbor. Just like today, it was my neighbor. This is what it means to have abundance, real abundance. You see a need that must be met, and you work to meet it. And that's exactly what the man in Jesus' parable failed to do. He had every opportunity to use his good fortune to serve those around him, and maybe it would not have saved his life, but it would have saved his soul from the pain of being alienated from his own humanity. I think this was Jesus' real message to the brothers. Instead of squabbling over the inheritance, they should look for ways that their wealth can be used to meet the needs of those around them. So my question for you is this: what is the abundance in your life right now that God is calling on you to share with others? Maybe it is your money. But maybe your abundance is something else right now. It could be your time, your energy, your talents, your wisdom. It could be your prayers. Some of you have a very abundant prayer life. It could simply be the love that's in your heart that God is calling on you to share with somebody who needs it. And what are the areas in your life that are limited by scarcity thinking? What are the things that you feel like you will never have enough of? Rest? Family time? Love? One of the things about scarcity thinking is that not only does it keep us from sharing what we have with our neighbors, but it keeps us from accepting the abundance that others want to share with us. Today is Communion Sunday. Pastor Susan said in her sermon 2 weeks ago that this is not our table. This is Jesus' table. We may be lucky enough to have it in our house, but we are guests at the feast. And let me tell you, there is an abundance at Jesus' table. Enough for every single person and then some. When we gather around it, it is a sign of the abundance that is God's presence among us. And it is a reminder that no one needs to go away hungry. The same is true of this planet. There is more than enough here to sustain every single person and still care for the earth. We could live in a world where everyone has a home, where every child is fed, where poverty ceases to exist. All we have to do is choose it. May it be so.